Stephanie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
tonight's speaker, his name is Lee T. He's telling his story for the first time here, so everybody welcome him, and we look forward to enjoying your story.
Hey everybody, my name is Lee, I'm an alcoholic. My sober birthday is November 8th, 2012. I've been sober for a little over 5 years right now. I'm a full-time musician here in Nashville. A big shocker, right? I play keyboards, guitars, and acoustic guitar, and I get to travel the world playing music for a living. Music has always been there for my life. And when I graduated in Wisconsin, graduated college, I made the decision to move here to Nashville and play for a country music artist. And that's all I've been doing since, and that was 22 years ago. So I'm going to talk about what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, and I'm going to use this to outline my story, because speaking's not my thing. I'm normally behind keyboards, or I have a guitar in front of me, and that's my thing. So I'm going to be reading a little bit, I'll probably be sweating. So Stacy, who could not be here tonight, is responsible for getting me here. You guys have probably seen me a couple Wednesday nights. I can never make this meeting because I'm always on the road. So I'm really thankful that schedule's worked out and y'all asked me to do this. And I'm very grateful for y'all listening. So thank you. Prior to AA, my story would have been completely different. My struggles were harder than yours. My drama was worse than yours. My life was tough, unfair, and difficult. I couldn't sleep, I wasn't happy, and none of this was my fault. Obviously, this is all bullshit, right? I'm thankful for AA and everything that goes with it. My life is simple, easy, I sleep at night, and I'm happy. I grew up in Wisconsin, the land of dairy and booze. My mom and dad divorced when I was 3. Dad would get us every other weekend. Those weekends were stressful only because I never knew what shape Dad was going to be in. Dad was fun. He took us fishing. We hung out at his apartment, but that's all we ever really did. And after that, we would go to the bar and sit while he got drunk. Mind you, I'm 3, 4, 5 at this time, and my brother's 4 years older than me. And one of the nights, my brother and I were driven home in a cop car because Dad got arrested for a fight in the bar. And there was nobody to take us kids home. Dad always had different women around, and it was hard for us boys to keep them straight. And one time I said the wrong name, that got him pretty upset. Dad got sick of this, though, and he skipped to Mexico when I was 7. He avoided paying child support, and I didn't hear from him until I was able to track him down with a private investigator who I found down the road. I was 26. I didn't want anything from him. I just wanted to talk to him, and I wanted some answers. He's still an alcoholic. He's still a drug user. He admitted to me that he uses cocaine. He sold cocaine, and at one point in the state of California, he owned 150 Gold Wing motorcycles. And I said, why? He says, because I could. Money, you know? And then he started telling me that he got kicked out of the state of California. And he actually compared, I was talking about life on the road and how we eat different food every day, catering, and how it's different. And he goes, yeah, it's just like the different prisons I've been in. Yeah. So anyways, I don't have any more contact with Dad because he wanted to move here and be with his boy, and he thinks I make a lot of money. So that got shut down. Anyways, that's Dad. My mom is what you would call controlling, enabling, codependent, questionable addiction problems with her food, definite control issues. Mom worked hard when we were growing up. She always had 2 jobs, but she always blamed us kids for what happened with Dad, blaming us kids that she had to work. She was never happy with the house we lived in. She's a bit of a hoarder. She holds on to the past, and she really sets up unrealistic expectations for everyone around her. And I was one of them. There was some abuse there when we were kids, and like she would get really mad at us. And for 2 weeks, my brother and I hid out after school. We hid upstairs, and one weekend we were hungry, and we would run down to the refrigerator and grab food while she was in the bathroom. It was that bad. So when I got older, I got more independent, and the more she pushed back, the more I was in trouble, the more she disapproved what was going on. And I was doing stuff like I was class president, I was in student council, I was in band, a lot of leadership roles, things that you would think would be good. But she always felt like I should be spending more time with family. So when I moved to college in the big city of Milwaukee, I was told that I would be raped, mugged, and have no support from her. We got in a huge fight, and she looked at me and said the words, "I wish you were never born." So now, anyways, my brother, 4 years older than me, he came home from college, and he started cracking beers in the morning. So he was taken right after Dad's footsteps, definite alcoholic. He's been in recovery for, I think, 24, 25 years now, which is good for him. And I'm not going to judge him. He only went to about 4 or 5 meetings. He got too intimidated by the program, and a couple people approached him and said, "This is what you got to do to stay sober." So he's doing what he's doing. I'm glad he's sober. He can appreciate the program. And he's still living at home, so he's still under mom's care. Anyways, throughout school, let's move on. So throughout school, I was playing in different bands, and when I was 16, I was asked to play in this 50s, 60s band that was about an hour away. So I got the car from mom. She let me do that. I'd already been smoking cigarettes and hiding them for about a year or two. When I got this gig, of course, I could drive and play in a bar with smoke-filled air. So I'm only telling you this because this is how the patterns are starting to develop. I would take the car on the way to the gig, stop at the first gas station, pull in, buy a pack of Marlboro menthol lights and one of those pine tree air fresheners, and stick it in the car. And I could get away with smoking in the car. Mom never knew because, you know, there was smoking in the bar. My clothes would reek of cigarette smoke. My gear would, anyways. So I was pulling it off, and she kept saying, "Boy, these pine tree air fresheners are really lasting a long time." Because every week I was replacing them. So anyways, I was getting away with the lying, and it worked. I never drank up to this point. I was against it. I saw what it did to my father and my brother, and I didn't want to be like them. But playing in bars, I saw people having fun, a lot of fun. And I thought these people were feeling good, laughing, dancing. I learned stuff. I learned that if you had a headache and you had a drink, the headache would go away. I didn't see the ugly side. Then I got into college, and I found blackberry brandy, and my first real drunk was a complete blackout. I remember sitting in McDonald's, you know, soaking up the booze, and the next thing I know, I was in my dorm room waking up. One of the bands that I played in was a reggae band. We were on break. The band was in the van. I went out to the van. They rolled down the window. I was like, "Man, your van smells like shit." So I started smoking pot at that point. I was holding decent grades, but I was always excelling at music. Being hungover and wrecked in college was accepted. My trumpet professor, I was playing trumpet at the time, we would have this master class on Friday with a bunch of us, all the trumpet players would come in and play. And his name was Wayne, he was from Texas, and we were just reeking of tequila. And he looked at me and he says, "Boy, what's wrong with you?" And I said, "Well, we were drinking tequila last night." He says, "Damn it, I told you to drink gin." And Wayne was the type of guy, he always had a bottle right there. So that's the type of thing, you know, in the band we partied, puking was normal, and it just the shenanigans that go on with it late night, it was fun, we were kids. Drinking was fun. So I need to back up at this point and introduce one more person. When things started to get rough with my mom, I latched onto my girlfriend, Amy, who allowed me to be a kid. She allowed me to do my music without the responsibilities of adulthood. She basically took over the role of my mother, and I didn't realize this until much, much later. We dated on and off through college. When she graduated, she moved to me in Milwaukee. When I made the decision to move to Nashville, she moved with me. So I graduated college after I taught music for a little bit, made the decision to come here, like I said, 22 years ago. Within 2.5 weeks, I had an audition with a job for a gig a guy that was on a major label. He was a touring artist. So I was getting on a touring bus, touring around the United States, playing clubs, theaters, whatever it took to get this new artist going. He was Mormon. Here's another story. Mormons are great, but they have strict rules on drinking, and there was no drinking on the bus. On the bus, mind you. So there we go with my drinking again. The fiddle player and I were the only two non-Mormons, so we were smoking and drinking, and we would get on the bus. It was totally dysfunctional, sneaking, hiding, doing whatever we could. So Amy moved to Nashville, bought me a car, provided a place to live, basically while I was chasing my dream. We'd been dating on and off so long, she got to the point where she was expecting a ring. I was on tour the month of December, and when I landed at the airport, I figured I had another day to buy Christmas presents, not realizing it was December 24th. Yeah, no ring, no presents for anybody. Just showing you how self-centered I was. I wasn't thinking about anybody else. Later that next year, my boss got really sick, so we ran away and got married. I really didn't want to, in hindsight, but I needed the insurance, and I felt guilty. This is about honesty, right? So I felt guilty for the years that she, you know, all the stuff she had given to me, and it was easier to marry her than make her upset. You know, so I bounced around in Nashville networking, bouncing from gig to gig, moving up the ladders. I never lost a job because of my drinking. I never got fired because of my drinking. It wasn't looked at as being out of control, not up to this point. My sleep patterns were getting whacked out. You know, I went to Vanderbilt and did a sleep study. After like 6 hours of sleeping, they woke me up, and actually I was awake, and they said, we got all the information we need. And they prescribed to me diazepam, which is Valium, and Ambien. So y'all, put me on a tour bus with alcohol, because now I'm playing for a different artist, alcohol and pills that I can take. And of course, you're not supposed to take them with alcohol, but they obviously work better with alcohol. So there was times in the morning on the bus where I was forgetting what I was saying because of the Ambien. There were nights leaving the house after drinking martinis. Oh, this is a good one. I drank a martini at the house, chewed an Ambien, and thought it would be a great idea to go to my neighbor's house who was having a party. I didn't know anybody. I looked up at the pictures on the wall and realized I don't even hang out with these people. Like, it was awesome. Somehow I made it home that night and got up. The bad part about it is, you know, I didn't wake up the next morning, and Amy had to come home at lunchtime to see if I'd woken up. She physically was shaking me, and no response. So that's, drinking was now becoming not fun. She knew I had a drinking problem. She didn't want to admit it. I didn't want to admit it. She thought she could fix me by staying close and doing all the things, basically controlling me and being my mother. So I did what any good alcoholic did, I hid it more. I had bottles stashed on the bus, I had a bottle stashed at home in guitar cases, guitar amps, anywhere that people wouldn't look. I'd put the empties in my guitar case, in an acoustic guitar case because it was bigger, and I'd throw them out, yeah, about once a week when it got full. And another thing that got really tiring was I'd walk into, you know, the liquor cabinet, and I could see how much booze was exactly in a bottle. And I thought everybody watched how much booze was in a bottle, but they don't really. So I would drink it down, you know, have a martini at home. And then while she was out of the room, drink some more. Oh, shit. So now I'm filling this thing up with water until the next morning where I can run to the liquor store. I don't have enough money to buy the good gin anymore, so I'm buying the cheap gin. The headaches and the hangovers are getting worse. The rat race is just starting. My health is declining. I'm putting on weight. I'm sweaty. I was red in the face. Long story short, I went to the doctor. My triglyceride level, which is supposed to be below 200, was at 1476. After much debate and talking about my family history, and who my father was and what he was an alcoholic. The doctor actually diagnosed me with hereditary liver dysfunction. I got away with it again. Unbelievable. And I know this is all my fault. It's just, this is how it's going. So I quit drinking for a year and a half. Almost an ultimatum, but I never stopped, you know, from home, but I never stopped taking Ambien, Valium, or other sleeping pills that I was buying. I was a dry drunk. I was moody, self-centered, all the things that went along with it. Sometime I'd chew half an Ambien to get through situations, and I started playing for a new artist on the road, and when it came to his hit song, there was a big piano intro. Before the first show, thousands and thousands of people, I chewed half an Ambien because I figured that would calm my nerves. I don't remember playing that, and I remember him coming up to me afterwards saying, "Buddy, I think you need to work on that a little bit more." So that's what I was starting to do. I was losing my pill bottles in hotel rooms. Housekeeping was taking them. TSA took them out of my bag. You get the drift, right? So I was taking too many. Then one night I was at a wedding I didn't want to be at. It was a Russian wedding. The girl was from Moldova, and they had shots of vodka out on the table. And Amy asked me to go get her a drink, and while she wasn't looking, I pounded down three or four of those vodka shots without even thinking about it. Immediately, the feeling was immense. It just ran through my body. I started to sweat. I was red, and the anxiety and everything picked up right where it left off, and it was awful. I definitely had a routine to my alcoholism. I had a couple different liquor stores I would hit. Of course, you couldn't go to the same liquor store every day. No, right? So I would go to this particular one, and the guy knew I was a keyboard player, and we'd talk about Hammond B3 organs. Pretty cool, pretty normal. He always knew to grab me a half pint of Smirnoff Red. So I'm showing up with my then wife, who was having a party and legitimately had to buy booze. So we walk in the door, and he goes, "Hey, how's it going?" And I'm like, "No." Another funny thing that I used to do on the road, just this goes into the insanity part of it for me. I love to ride a bike. I love to pedal bike. And I would take a pedal bike out on the road, 10-speed, 12-speed, whatever you want to call it. And I used to ride for exercise, like doing 20, 26 miles a day. But all that was doing was isolating me, isolating from the family that I had out on the road. But it was allowing me also to get over my hangover pretty quick because I was pounding water and working out. The other thing is when you're on the road and you stop with a tour bus, you can't get anywhere. Years ago, there wasn't Uber. There wasn't a taxi you could really call. So what did the bike allow me to do? Go to the liquor store. And how would I bring it back? In the empty water bottles. So my music career is still growing, moving up the ladder, better gigs. My relationship at home is dwindling, and we're growing apart. She's never spending time at home, probably because she didn't want to put up with me. So out on the road, one night after the show, I met somebody. I met a girl, and we exchanged numbers, texted, decided to talk on the phone, and I quickly found out she was a trust fund baby. I had to Google what a trust fund baby was, and when I looked it up, it began to be rather intriguing. As you can only imagine, this is another thing that I was hiding from everybody. I couldn't tell people at home. I couldn't tell the boys on the bus. You know, nobody. It just took over my life. In a weird sort of way, this chapter proved to be the thing that saved my life. It was detrimental marriage number one. So drama, everything came to a head at home. I just kept saying to her, "I want to be happy. I just want to be happy." I knew telling her, Amy, the news of me stepping out would not go well. So I made up my mind. I told her. I grabbed my guitar in my backpack, and I left to get on a plane to fly to California with just that. 14 years of marriage, 4 cars, a house that's almost paid off, done. On the other hand, this was exciting, terrifying, sad, all the emotions that went with it. I was disappointed with myself, I was ashamed, and I was embarrassed. I thought this new person with all this money was really going to take care of me like she said she was. And I was saved, right? But all I did was pack up in that backpack all my emotional crap, and I took it right along with me. So Leah lived in Palm Springs, 2 miles away from the Betty Ford Center. When I got off the plane, she soon realized what shape I was in. We flew to a gig and flew home. And when we flew home, I wound up right in a hospital for severe stomach problems, almost a pancreatitis. She told the doctor how much I was drinking. And we made an agreement right there and then that we were going to get me off Ambien and the diazepam. And I was going to quit drinking, and she was going to control it. And she was going to make things work. I was going to make things work. The other option was pretty blunt. She says, "You fuck up, I'm sending you to Betty Ford. This disease is telling me I got this. I can handle this." And I really thought I could. And I thought I could, you know, control this on my own. So we move everyone to Nashville. And I say everyone, there's 3 kids involved. I'm not drinking, but I'm way over my head. I'm still a kid myself, but now I'm trying to be the man of the house the best I can to live up to this facade. I'm living in a big house in Belmede. I'm driving a fancy-ass sports car. New clothes, new life, same shit. So I lasted for about 3 to 4 months, and in that time I thought it would be a great idea, as soon as my divorce was done, to get married. Because then she couldn't get rid of me. By now, my bandmates, who we've been together, and my boss for 5 years, are just shaking their heads. They're like, "What is going on? My appearance changed. I put on weight again. I wasn't happy. I wasn't in love. And I got myself into another situation where I was really stuck. I mean, y'all, I looked like Sammy Hagar meets, like, Guy Fieri, that chef. My hair was bleach blonde, like an awful yellow color. And it was just, that's the way I was going, you know? So we had a huge party at the house, and once again, vodka found me. And I ended up falling that night and tearing this rotator cuff. I pulled 2 chips of bone off my shoulder. Next night, we're playing downtown for the 4th of July celebration. I couldn't even get this guitar off to get back to playing keyboards. So I couldn't raise this arm. So I'm playing keyboards like this. And we had to go on tour, and I didn't get my arm fixed until Thanksgiving that year. So alcohol really stepped up its game to help with the pain at that point. The booze from the party migrated downstairs next to the refrigerator by the Gatorade. So when anybody wanted a Gatorade, I was happy to oblige and go downstairs and run and get Gatorade and then run back upstairs. Nothing's changed. I could go on and on about how bad things got, but I was slurring my speech, still lying about drinking. Both these people had sinus problems and couldn't smell the booze on me. I'm amazed by this because I think we can all tell when somebody's been drinking. Just by the smell that comes out of them, out of their body, out of their pores. Things got bad enough, one hangover, that I convinced Leah that it would be a good idea that I call my buddy over and we smoke weed in the house with the kids around. Until I started to feel good the next morning. Of course, I drank a lot that night. And I was drinking about 1 liter of vodka a day. The guys on the bus were sick of me. They gave me the talk. They sat down with me. They took all the booze off our bus, but I just went to the crew bus and grabbed it. And I was shaking violently. So I was waking up in the morning to drink so nobody else would see me shake. There was one morning I woke up in a hotel room and had a literal explosion that went off in my head. It sounded like a gunshot. And it made me sit up, and I proceeded to just projectile vomit across the bed. Like, that's how violent this was getting. The next morning after I smoked pot in the house, I couldn't even form words. She looked at me, Leah looked at me, and says, "What's wrong with you?" somehow I found the words to say, I've been drinking. She didn't look at me. She grabbed the phone. She knew the number to the Betty Ford Center. She had it memorized and she was ready. So she started talking. In my heart at that moment, I said, thank God it's over. Y'all, I couldn't drive anywhere. I couldn't remember how to get places. I mean, I knew about where places were, but like roads were fuzzy. Like it was just bad. I'd lied at home. I'd lied to everybody. I'd made a mess of every situation. Luckily, my employer sent me an email and he said he was 100% behind me. Take all the time I need. And that meant a lot to me. So off to the Betty Ford Center I go on a plane with a chaperone. And I drink on the plane because you can't go into rehab sober. Come on. Come on. So there I was admitted on a 30-day plan, and I was pretty sure I was still coming home and everything would be okay, right? People at the Betty Ford were great. I went through a couple days of detox. Finally, the tremors were gone. You know, and us guys would sit around late at night in our dorm room and look at each other and go, we're smart guys, right? How did we end up in here? And of course, we trade war stories and about who was drunker and just proving what idiots we were. But it worked. It worked, y'all. And during our small groups, I figured out what trauma was in my life, what triggers there were, and I figured out my mommy issues, which was huge. I was finally dealing with my shit. I didn't have any contact from home. I talked to Leah probably 5 minutes every other weekend. She wouldn't come and see me. And when I got out, I was asked not to come home for a couple days. And it was just difficult from then on. So I'm back in Nashville, and I would go living over in Belmead area. I would go to meetings and have to come home and be another person. Because Leah, the girl that sent me to rehab, now didn't want to be with an alcoholic. She didn't want to learn about it. She was embarrassed, on and on. This went on for another year before it really fell apart. So I'm going to fast forward here. And you can understand what a dangerous position that is, to go to meetings, be that person, come home and have to be another person. Totally dangerous. She ended up trying to hook up with somebody. I busted her. She didn't realize her texts were also going to her iPad. So I was out of there. And a year and a half after rehab, I finally hit my low. My emotional low is what I call it. So there I am driving in my truck to the apartment that I just got. I didn't have friends to call. I had lost my house, my home, my wife, who was supposed to save me. And I had no family back home in Wisconsin. I'd burned that bridge. I was alone for the first time in my life. So out of sheer desperation, I flipped over my medical card. I did have insurance, and I found a therapist who was absolutely phenomenal. He had a specialty in addiction. I learned a lot quickly, and it's pretty amazing how much is in the big book and how much you can learn from other alcoholics. So I was great. I was going to meetings every day. And for once, I could be who I was and not have to hide. Like, y'all, this is the first time in my life I'm not hiding cigarettes, I'm not hiding booze, I'm not hiding my personality. It's totally freeing. I had an apartment in Green Hills, and I'm right across from Woodmont Christian Church. And there's a meeting house right across the street, so I'm going to church there, hitting meetings. It was awesome. It wasn't easy, you know. I wrestled with the same thoughts. Why can't I drink like others? What happened? You know, but slowly the days went on day by day. My buddy Kevin calls me every day through this. He's a detective up in Cape Cod. Come to find out, his dad has 34 years. Things got better, just as the promises tell us. Fear started to slip away. I figured out what I like to do. I figured out how I wanted to dress. Go figure. I figured out what food I wanted to eat. So drinking was just a symptom of my thinking. I was going to church, going out with friends, I was working out, and most of all, I was working on myself. I could not do this without God. God is my higher power. And y'all, he was about to show me what's next. Because this is where it gets really good. This is the what it's like now. And I can get away from my notes for a little bit on this one. So I'm going to meetings, finding out about myself, figuring things out, and I start dating. And I'm at the airport. And I'm flying back. I kind of was repeating a pattern. And I think God put me in this position. And he goes, no, this is what you need to do. So I flew from California through Houston, from Houston to Nashville. And I get to the Nashville baggage claim. And there's this girl over there who's looking at me. And honestly, I kind of did one of these, like, she is not looking at me. And she was. And so I was like, wow, okay, she's really pretty. And she went and talked to her friends. So I ran to the bathroom and I quick did a booger check and checked my teeth and my hair. And I came back out, she didn't notice. So she got done talking to her friend and I'm like, no way am I gonna go over there and talk to her. No way, forget it. She's probably married, whatever. So I make my way over to the carousel and her bag comes out at the same time. So I reach down, grab her bag, and she says, do I know you? And I'm not gonna say, well, I'm Lee, I play for Darius Rucker, because that didn't work out the last time, right? And honestly, who cares? You know, I play music for a living. I'm not gonna do that the rest of my life. I'm Lee, you know? So we started talking. She asked me, you know, what church do I go to? And I was like, aha, okay. We started talking and we decided to have coffee. And here's the thing. So I tell my friends, my bandmates, what just happened. And they see the excitement. And I said, you know, we're going to go out on a date. And this is like the first time in my life, like I'm really doing this. And I got their advice. So you see what happened is I actually asked somebody else's advice rather than just running off. We agreed to meet up for coffee. We went to Bongo Java, and which was perfect because if the talk went well, then there was three restaurants we could pick from right down the road, you know? I get there early, I'm nervous, I'm texting my buddies, and she comes in, she's looking great, and she gets her coffee, and she sits down, and she goes, so, tell me about yourself. And I'm like, fuck. Here it comes. From everything that I've learned in AA, in treatment, in my recovery, I had to be honest. This was the time. I have goosebumps right now because this was very vulnerable for me. So I was like, well, you know, we started talking and I said, yeah, I'm just recently divorced for the second time. You know, and she was really nice and sweet. And she's like, that's okay. We all go through things. And I've been married too. And I was like, okay, great. So we were talking and I found out that she doesn't date musicians. Great. So the talk goes really well. We get done with coffee. We go over and we have Mexican food. The waitress comes up to us and says, what would you guys like to drink? Margaritas, blah, blah, blah. And she looks at me and she says, do you drink? And I said, no. She goes, okay, Diet Coke. And I said, I'll have a Diet Coke too. And we talked about it. And I said, I'm in recovery. And she says, how long do you have? And I could see the look on her face. It was kind of troubling. Musician, divorced twice, early in recovery, got a year and a half under his belt. And so we talked about it, and I later found out, you know, she had had an experience, a bad experience with somebody who was a month sober and told her that he was going to drink again. So her experience with recovering alcoholics was bad. Anyways, we get out to the car, she pats me, and I'm like, I'm never going to see this woman ever again. I get to my truck, my phone rings. Remember how she said she didn't date musicians? It's because she knows musicians. She's a singer. So she calls me and she says, hey, when we talked about a specific song, she says, hey, I want to give you my CD. Are you still around? So she pulls up, gives me the CD, but that wasn't the reason she wanted to talk to me. She says, if I'm getting this right, she says, I'm not going to judge you. We all screw up in life. We all make mistakes. And we all have our pasts. And I said, well, as a musician, let me prove you wrong, you know, about being a musician. So we started dating. We had real discussions. She's real supportive of my recovery. We talk about life, hopes, dreams. We talk about the people around us. And, you know, people around us, our friends, got to see this relationship grow, a healthy relationship. They approved. And they would actually tell me they approved. So, y'all, I married this girl October 1st, 2016, in front of our friends, family, and God. I would like to introduce Tiffany Turner. So, I only bring this up because she's so supportive of you settle down. I know, right? She's so supportive of what I do, and just truly, we had a conversation last night about our past that we still hadn't had, and it's okay, and there's a part of me that still fears, and I want to pull back, and I want to hide, but I don't have to. With my mom and brother, we're dealing with them. We've said our stories, and we moved on. It's best to just keep the phone call to about 5 minutes. Boundaries are a good thing, and that's okay. And all of this I wouldn't be able to do this if I wasn't sober. None of it. I would have messed it up. I really don't miss how hard it is to be an alcoholic. The constant thoughts, plotting, maneuvering, scheming just to drink, forgetting which lies I told, forgetting which stories I made up. Honesty is the best policy, and there's times where I struggle not with honesty, but with expressing myself correctly. I'm definitely a person who needs to think over things. Sometimes I get things wrong, and I don't express myself correctly, and right away. And I'll go back and I'll say, okay, when we were talking about this, this is what I actually meant. And it's nice to do that. I'm not the picture-perfect person for AA. I don't travel to as many, or I don't go to as many meetings as I probably should. The cool thing, though, is I do get to travel and hit meetings all over. I got a great one I love to go to in New York City. I got to go to one in Ireland because I'm thinking, man, those Irish can drink, right? So that's pretty cool. I do love how this program, and if you implement this way of life into your everyday, people will want what you have. They really will. I have non-alcoholic friends come up to me and ask me how I deal with life so well. That's huge. I don't have to worry about going to bed, worrying about if somebody's going to find out something about me. I don't have to worry about I still have to worry about money. That's okay. I do not want to drink ever again. The pain and the hardships that I endured during my drinking days scare the shit out of me, and I don't want to die. Every morning before my feet hit the floor, even if it's for a second, I say in my head, thank God I'm sober today. My feet hit the floor, I'm off to it. I've got too much to lose. I've got a beautiful wife who loves me for who I am. We have a home. I have a good job. I have my health. And I know that that would all disappear in a moment's notice if I were to pick up a drink. So, my buddy up in Cape Cod turned me onto this show called House of Cards, which you probably all have heard about now because of Kevin Spacey. He told me about this years ago, and he said, there's something in this you need to see and hear. So, for any of you struggling or, you know, looking for a little phrase to get you through, this really helped me out. The character's name is Doug Stamper, works in the White House. And the actor's name is Michael Kelly. He was actually a friend of the band, and I got to talk to him about this scene, so it's really pretty cool. And I wish I could speak like this, so I'm going to put my numbers on here and pretend this is me, and I work at the White House. So here we go. I'm Lee. I'm an alcoholic. One of the things I do for a living is account. I count votes. Yeas, nays, neutrals, abstaining. And I'm good at it. But the most important count I have to do has nothing to do with work. It's the number of days since November 12th, 2012. And as of this morning, that's 1,934 days. The bigger that number gets, the more it frightens me. Because all I know is that it takes one drink for that number to go back to zero. Most people see fear as weakness. It can be. Sometimes for my job, I have to put the fear in other people. I know that's not right, but if I'm honest, like the fourth step asks us to be, I have to be ruthless, because failure is not an option. Same goes for my sobriety. I have to be ruthless with myself. I have to use my fear. It makes me stronger. Like everyone else in this room, I can't control who I am, but I can control the zero. Fuck the zero.
Thank you.
There you go.
Thanks, Lee.
Thanks, y'all. Thanks, Lee.